This is the BBC Light Programme.
At Easter 1964, Auntie Beebe got the shock of her life.
This is Radio Caroline on 199. The time is 12 o'clock. Hello, this is Chris Moore. I'll be with you playing records for the next 2 hours. Let's listen first of all to Frank...
Offshore commercial radio had arrived in Britain. Radio Caroline broadcast from a boat anchored outside British territorial waters, and as such wasn't subject to the strict laws that had previously governed British broadcasting. Very quickly the new station attracted a huge audience, and it wasn't long before other radio stations followed, among them one set up by Dave Such, who chose to use an abandoned anti-aircraft fort in the Thames estuary. We'll be looking at the other fort-based radio stations later, but first we'll let Dave Such, better known as pop singer Screaming Lord Such, tell how he started his radio station.
This is Radio Such on 197 meters, medium wave. Well now, you lucky people, if you'd like a request on Radio Such, then write to Radio Such, King's Agency, number 7 Denmark Street, London, WC2.
I thought the best thing to do is to run my own station, and that's exactly what I did. Set up Radio Such, and first of all, we started from an old boat. We rented that when he'd finished his rounds of fishing, so he was fishing, trawling in the mornings, 12 o'clock onwards. It was a radio station. The only trouble was it was covered in fish scales and it stunk to heaven. And when all the reporters and press people come on, they all nearly killed themselves skating about. We used that for quite some time until the trawler had its insurance taken away because they said that they insured it for a fishing boat and not for a commercial radio station. So with no insurance, the guy panicked and said, you've got to get another boat or something, you know. And we tried to get some other boats around the same harbour, but had no luck. So in the end, just on one of our last broadcasts out there in the sea, we noticed these disused forts. And we said, well, why can't we go on them? And he said, well, I don't know. I don't know who they belong to. So we made some inquiries and found out that they were ex-government forts, which hadn't been used for 70 years. So through a solicitor and everything, we found out that it's been abandoned out there as far as the government was concerned. So we just took them over and claim squatters' rights.
The Shivering Sands Army Fort was used for the first test from Radio Such on May the 27th, 1964. The radio equipment was very primitive to start with, as the station's engineer Tony Pine recalls.
We had a look at his installation, which was crazy, absolutely crazy. You know, they're running on batteries, had to be charged every few hours. They're on the air and off the air. And he had with him, as was his way, three or four, I can't remember, gorgeous birds with him on the forts. And several other chaps milling around, obviously well out of their depth as regards being in the middle of the estuary, 10 miles from anywhere. The difficulties involved of being out of contact with the shore were, it showed, you know. Investigated his equipment, such as it was, suggested that no way was it powerful enough to do a reasonable job.
At first, when we first started, everything was worked off of batteries, so it was really Mickey Mousey, and batteries would run down and we couldn't transmit. It was a crazy thing. But once we got going on that, we got a generator going and we got proper big-sized turntables, garrards and all the lot, you know, everything properly. Well, the funny thing is, the stuff was transmitted with ex-Navy stuff which we had bought. So the government was against us, and we were running from government gun towers with government ex-Navy equipment as well, so it was a rather cheek on that respect. But it worked very good. It was all second-hand gear, with generators and transmitters, and we had a good output, we had a good radius. It just fitted absolutely perfect for a radio station. It had storage space and they had proper toilets and bathrooms, and it was just like a castle in the middle of the sea. So we were completely knocked out with it, and we really did enjoy it. We was getting a lot of respect for being there because we had the guts to take them over and run the radio station from it. And we had threats with the Navy at one stage British government told them to get us off, and we refused to get off. And we had all the press behind us, and TV, everyone supporting us. And in the middle of threatening us and telling us to get off, they just pulled up anchor, a huge battleship, and cleared off. And the headlines the next day was Lord Such turns back the Navy.
Yeah, this is Radio Such on 197, and that was Freddie Cannon with The Urge. Now here's Handy Maine by Jimmy Jones. I wonder if he really is.
Well, I was doing the thing on there because I knew when I made records, I was a very wild act and too far ahead for its day and age, and the BBC would never play my records. Luxembourg wouldn't play my records, so there was no one left. So I decided to play a lot of my own records on there, obviously, but plus a lot of my other colleagues in the business, who up to that time didn't get a lot of airplay. People like Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, and Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers, and a lot of my own personal friends, the Outlaws, and bands like this, would get now and again a little play, but I'd play whole albums, you know, both sides for them. And then I did a whole series of events where I asked for any local bands struggling that have just made a record or made demonstration records, send them in and we'll play them over the air. We was playing people's demonstration records and saying if there's any big record companies listening, which they were listening to them, you know, some of their staff, someone was always listening. So a few got discovered, you know, from us playing acetapes and their own tapes. So we got a few groups off the ground, which wasn't too bad.
The programmes for the station were divided into three time slots, noon to 2 p.m, 5 to 8 p.m, and 12:15 to 2:15 a.m. The early slots were mainly music shows, but the late night show was something different.
But we had many a laugh at the tour of them that are coming by with Fanny Hill and Lady Chatterley's Lover and some of these spicy epics that we'd be reading out. Or telling a few jokes a bit near the knuckle. We used to play a lot of Max Miller albums, which were at the time were banned from BBC again. Like everything that's anything with a bit of go in it and a bit of spunk is always banned from the BBC. It made a change to something like Coronation Street. We thought we'd really give them something they really wanted to hear. It's all nice and scandalous, you know, which was good. It kept people listening, and people that didn't want to listen could switch off, but that's the kind of station we were. We didn't care.
Meanwhile, though, Screaming Lord Such was becoming more and more involved with his horror rock show.
So in the end, I was doing more and more of the rock and roll one-nighters and recording and touring, and then I was offered a very good tour of Australia and New Zealand, which I took. That was about 64, and handed it all over to Reg Calvert, and sold out to him.
Remember, all you people that want to send a request in, we'll be delighted to hear from you. The address to send them to is 7 Denmark Street, London, WC2. That's Screaming Lord Such Requests, 7 Denmark Street, London, WC2. My name is Chris Croft, but I'm going off tomorrow because I'm only here on a temporary basis. I've been here since Tuesday, as many of you will know, and I don't know whether I shall be back again. I do hope so, because I've enjoyed being your disc jockey for the past week, or the past 5 days. At any rate, I hope I can come back and do a bit more for you. Right now, I'm going to play you a record by the Everly Brothers. It's the Ferris Wheel.
Walking down Denmark Street one day, this is really one of those strange things that happens to one once in a lifetime. Sort of change of your whole career by pure accident. As I passed this doorway that said Radio Such on it, and I marched straight in and said, I want to be a DJ. And purely by chance, the person who turned out to be Reg Calvert said to me that he'd just changed the name from Radio Such to Radio City. He got a new transmitter there, going there that week, and he was short of people to keep the thing ticking over. So he said, right, you can come down for a week. He wasn't going to pay me any money. And you know, take it from there sort of thing. So I went down. I was on the station, in fact. I went down with Reg Calvert, in fact, that afternoon, stayed in Whitstable that night. The weather was too rough to go out that night, and the following day I was on the station. Hey presto. That would have been September 64. And then the following week, he evidently thought I was good enough and offered me the princely sum of £5 a week to stay there.
Chris Cross recalling how he started with Radio City. The Forts were an awe-inspiring sight and very different from how people imagine them, as Terry Dawson remembers.
Well, it was nothing as I imagined it, you know, because people said, oh, you're going to work out on the Forts, and I said, yeah. And I expected to see a fort, you know, a sort of big brick thing with holes for pointing rifles to and flagpoles and the like. And then, of course, you go out there and you see these sardine tins on legs.
What looked to be quite a small object from the beach. I'd never been to the towers before. I'd never seen photographs or anything. We got there and there's this thing. You looked up and up and up and you thought, you know, what's all this? I'm not going up there. And it was something like 60 feet from the bottom of the sea level to the bottom of the tower, and then another 60 feet to the top. The ascent from the boat, or ascent onto the ladder from the boat, was another thing. You had, first of all, to get to the bottom of the first ladder, which was often several feet, depending on the condition of the tide. And with a tower, it doesn't move. It's not like a boat. When you come alongside a boat, the boat's moving one way and the other boat's moving the other way, so you get a bit of wash up through and you jump across. Well, it's not quite like that with a tower. You go up and the boat smashes against the side and the rubber tires don't really put up with it anyway, and everything tremors and shakes the hell out of the place. Jump to the ladder, scramble up that like hell before the boat comes up and meets you, and it's quite a rise of tide there. Right, 7 feet. Then it was a case of get to this greasy platform, and one nearly always falls off that and slips a bit down a bit. Then to a second landing, and then up through one single ladder into the middle of the tower, which allows access, as you probably know, for one person at a time.
Bob Leroy recalling the problems of getting onto the fault. Conditions on Shivering Sands had improved since the days of Radio Such. A new transmitter had been installed, along with a 240-foot high mast on top of the tower, which in itself was around 100 foot high.
It was in fairly good condition structurally, as the War Department had left it. All the doors and windows were intact. It hadn't suffered any vandalism, as it wouldn't out there, of course. Not many people walking past as those stones. And the roof was sound. It was draft-proof, which was some importance. But as far as the living conditions were what we could make out of them. We had a camp bed each and a sleeping bag. We had a single camping gas ring to cook on, I think. Lots of tins of food. Some sort of a container for fresh water for drinking, which was used very sparingly. And everything else was salt water, which we hauled up on a bucket with a rope.
Whereas the ships, in fact, imported duty-free cigarettes and drink. We never did. Drink was never allowed on the station. Cigarettes were bought in this country, so everyday food, well, as I supplied it from my then general stores that I had in the town, it was all very good.
For all your groceries and for a great many other requirements, visit Pines General Stores, 15 Island Wall, Whitstable. Open now till 8 o'clock every night. Phone Whitstable 4841 for Pines General Stores, 15 Island Wall, Whitstable.
The studios themselves, they were primitive, but they worked. It was much like today's modern comparison. I think you can class reasonable-sounding discotheque by it. It was literally Garrard SB25s with Decca DRAM heads through an ordinary passive three-channel mixer, a Brunel tape deck, which was situated to the left of you with an ordinary cue button which needed miles a litre before it could go on cue. No slip pads. We didn't have slip pads when we started. We made some felt ones later on. AKG microphone, Eagle-type meter mounted in the wall. A little light came on when the microphone button went on. Two Farragraphs, always one on shore being repaired, one on the station working if you're lucky.
That's rather nice, isn't it, for Frank and Brenda and all the boys who asked us to play a record with Punch, The Foremost, and Baby, I Need Your Lovin'. They go on to say lots and lots of nice things about Radio City and certainly enjoy our programmes, and we certainly hope you do. If you'd like to write to us for a record request or anything else, a dedication or an advertising rate card, our address is Radio City, 28 Oxford Street, Whitstable in Kent. This is Radio City on 299 metres. Got a most peculiar noise. Can't make out what it is. Can you hear it? Oh dear. Right, let's get on with music, shall we, before I have the studio collapse around my ears.
Next to us, the top 20 format, to the right on a long bench, and all the Beatles and Stones stuff was there for 5x4 all the time. So you could always be sure of the Beatles and Stones record programme without any doubt. You didn't even need to prepare that. Just go and do a 5x4 at ease in there. Loads of requests for that. Probably the most requested radio show, in fact. Very, very popular.
Rich Calvert liked to use new names for Radio City. Tony Pine remembers some of them.
Dick was an original DJ, Dick Dixon. Paul Elby. Then Chris Cross. Then Tom Edwards. And after that, I'm so involved, I just lost count. They came and they went, and that was it, over a period of, 3 years. Again, engineers used to come and go. Myself and Dick were original, and Don Witt, of course, original engineers, I would say. He was one of the best engineers, Ian West and Phil Perkins. They actually stayed the longest. They were all there for their own particular reason. Some were there for the fame, some there for the power, some there to satisfy their knock against society. I was there to get out a free radio station.
In the early days, it tended to be three most of the time, very occasionally down to two. As things got better, after I'd been there perhaps, 6 or 8 months, things got a bit better organised. A bit more money had been put into the station, we had better equipment and we had more people. We got up to a massive total of 5 or even 6, as far as I can recall. We even had a cook at one stage, which was a great luxury. There was one occasion where I and my wife ran the station for about 3 days alone over Christmas. In fact, it was supposed to be 3 days, it turned into about 5 because of the bad weather. And in fact, most of the programmes had been pre-recorded on that occasion, but the job consisted of getting up about 6 o'clock in the morning, winding the handle on the diesel generator, which was a bit of a strain at that time of the morning, starting the transmitter up, warming it up, and then going on the air. And in the course of that few days, the transmitter actually went wrong. And much to my amazement, I actually mended it, which is one of the most extraordinary things I've ever done, I think, because I really didn't know what I was doing. And all was well.
All right there, folks, you're on to Gary Stevenson. This is Radio City. We do it from New York every day, Monday through Saturday, from noon until 1 o'clock. And right now, it is a Thursday. Don't forget to write to us. Write to me, Gary Stevens, Box 3713, Grand Central Station, New York, 10070. Keep those cards and letters coming in, because we love to hear from you.
Well, DJ, pure and simple, was as far as my job went, notionally, in point of fact, since there were only ever about 3 of us running the entire station and doing all the cooking and everything else that went to actually keep the place running or ticking over, I was a cook. I also became more or less the chief carpenter on the station. And eventually I became more or less the programme controller. I used to make up all the schedules to say when all the programmes went out and when the advertisements were scheduled to run and that sort of thing.
Hey, are you enjoying Radio City's programmes? If you're not, well, how would you like to tell us why not? Or better still, how would you like to tell all our listeners why you don't like Radio City? You know, you can do just that on Radio City's show, The Anti-City Show, which comes to you every Saturday on 299 at 12 o'clock. All you have to do is make a tape recording of all your criticisms of Radio City, and you can say exactly what you want, and send them to us, The Anti-City Show, Radio City, 7 Denmark Street, London, WC2. Remember, that's for the Anti-City Show, the most unusual programme on the air.
It was always top 20 format, but we did have quite a lot of quite interesting programmes. We had the Anti-City Show, which was tapes sent in by listeners, you know, criticising the station. We had Basildon Record Request Shows, we had you-name-it type record request shows, sponsored the A.A. Allen Show, you know, Voice of Prophecy. Quite a lot of live radio. I think we were one of the first stations to do live gigs, if you like. We had what we called the Radio City Dance Parties, held in local halls, recorded for the station, which was quite well done, and we used to broadcast those tapes quite regularly.
Towards the end of 1965, negotiations started with Radio Caroline. Dorothy Calvert explains.
Radio Caroline approached my husband with the idea of an amalgamation. This was to make Radio City a booster station for the Caroline network. When I say booster, I mean that the signals would be transmitted from the ship, and then with the aid of a larger transmitter and a better aerial, the signal would be boosted to a much higher power with a much greater coverage of England from Radio City. So the terms were agreed, and the advertising revenues were pooled. Radio Caroline started looking for a transmitter, and in the end informed my husband that they'd traced one and it was going to be delivered.
They supplied a transmitter, which was flown in from America, built in 1941, I think, or thereabouts, or probably prior to that. It was running, apparently. We had a note written on it by the previous engineers that it was actually operating when Pearl Harbor was bombed. So that you can imagine how old it was. And it really was a monster. It weighed 5 tons in lumps. It then went to Holland, came out from Holland by tender. We got most of it up on the tower. I dropped one unit weighing about a ton that went in the water, for which we were all very sorry. We had to go pick the damn thing out, get some divers down there, pick it up, clean it up and put it to rights.
As it was, this transmitter never worked, and subsequently the deal fell through. Radio London were next for the takeover bid, this time for the radio station UKGM, United Kingdom Good Music, and plans were well advanced when, on Monday, 20th of June 1966, a boarding party took over and closed down the Radio City Fort. This was led by Major Oliver Smedley, who owned and allegedly hadn't been paid for the old Radio Caroline transmitter.
Meanwhile, Red arrived back in London, was told that his appointment with Smedley was arranged for noon. So he went along, and there was Smedley, Kitty Black, Commander Horsley, and a Mr. Lovett. And they confronted him with the boarding party and a piece of paper which they wanted Wretch to sign, signing away 50% of Radio City profits.
Smedley, who was out in the cold, I presume, decided that he wanted a cut in the Radio City London deal. And to that end, sent out his thugs to take over the station, went round to see Reg and said, look, we've got your station, we want half the proceeds or we're not going to let you go back on the air. Reg, of course, didn't like this. He rang me up and said, what are we going to do? And I suggested that it should be dealt with really from the source of the trouble. You know, at source, this trouble should be dealt with, and he went to deal with it, presumably.
Bulletin, stand by. Here is a Radio London News Bulletin.
Dateline, Wednesday, June the 22nd, Essex. William Oliver Smedley has been charged with the murder of Reg Calvert, the head of Radio City, who was found dead in a house in Saffron Walden this morning. Smedley was remanded in custody for a fortnight. Mr. Calvert died from a gunshot wound in the chest. The next news on Radio London is at 2:30. This is Keith Skews reporting.
At 9 o'clock on Sunday evening, 26th of June, the boarding party left, and within an hour, Radio City was back on the air.
Good evening. This is Radio City broadcasting on 299 metres in the medium wave band. And I guess you've all read in the newspapers or heard on radio or TV the events of the past week as far as the station is concerned. So there's nothing more I can say right now than on behalf of fellow DJs Tom Edwards and Alan Clark, technicians Ian West and Phil Perkins, engineers Tony Pine and Paul Elvey, it's pretty good to be back again with you on the 299.
The station continued and things started to get back to near normal. Unfortunately, the situation wasn't to last. On the 8th of February 1967, Mrs. Dorothy Calvert was charged under the Wireless Telegraphy Act.
And I was summoned by Scotland Yard under the Wireless Telegraphy Act. This act means that you cannot transmit or run a broadcasting station or a radio in England without a licence. Of course, we understood we were outside territorial waters and we didn't need one, which was proved on the one hand and disproved on the other. We were taken to court. My solicitor prepared a very good case and we proved that we were outside territorial waters and also the fact that the court was not empowered to try this case because we were on the high seas. Unfortunately, we were found guilty and my instructions had been that that night had to be the last night for broadcasting. The boys closed down. It was a very, very moving time. Very sad. We all cried. But there was it. That was the death of Radio City.
And the time right now on Radio City, ladies and gentlemen, is exactly 12 midnight. So from Alan Clark.
Well, what can you say? Simply goodbye and many thanks to everyone. I've enjoyed my spell on Radio City and keep in touch, okay?
Paul Cramer.
Thank you, Tom. I'd like to say a very good night to everybody and thank them for a most enjoyable 10 months, and I hope that the listeners do something anyway to get us back on the air, because tomorrow morning, when you switch on, there'll be nothing on 299.
RWB.
Thanks very much, Tom, Paul, Alan, Ian, and everyone. I've had a great time. I've learned a terrible lot about what people can do under extreme conditions, and I've really enjoyed myself. I'm looking forward to something in the future. I don't know what at this stage. And for me, it's bye.
Ian McRae.
Well, just goodbye and good morning, and thanks for everything in the past. Been wonderful listeners. Without sounding too sentimental here, all the best of luck to you, and goodbye for now. We'd like to, just very quickly, if I can here, Tom, perhaps, I know the other stations listening to us right now, we'd like to sort of pass on any sort of goodbye messages, you know. We'll listen to them after we go off the air in a few minutes' time, okay?
Fine.
Bye for now.
Right, well, many thanks indeed to all the lads, and of course our two technicians on duty at the moment, Graham, and also to Phil, and also our two DJs on shore at the moment, Adrian and Eric, and our other technicians, Bill and Ian West. For me, Tom Edwards, for the very last time on Radio City, it's a very good night to you, ladies and gentlemen. God bless, and thank you for being a marvellous audience. Good night, and goodbye.
June 1964, and a group of businessmen set up a radio station on the Red Sands Army Fort. They include Charles Evans, John Thompson, and Tom Pepper.
You are listening to a test transmission from Radio Invicta, broadcasting on 238 meters, 1259 kilocycles in the medium wave band. Reception reports, please, to the Chief Sound Engineer, Radio Invicta, Folkestone, Kent.
I was at home in Richmond. The doorbell went. My then wife answered it and she came up and said, "It's a funny looking character downstairs for you." And in came this fellow in dungarees, cap, welly boots right up to his thighs, and a pong of, I don't know what it was. It wasn't body odour, it was just an odd type of smell. He hadn't shaved. He said, "Oh," he said, "are you Ed Marino?" So I looked, I thought, "I'm going to get done in here." I said, "Yes." who I want you for my radio station. He said he couldn't afford to pay me very much. In fact, it was only £25 a week, which even in 64 was good money. But he desperately needed somebody to come up to Radio Invicta. And that was it. That was my meeting with Tom Pepper.
Ed Marino recalling how he joined the station.
I can remember when I got on there, I desperately wanted to use the toilet. So I said to Tom, you know, well, where are the toilets? He said, where the bloody hell do you think they are? Over the side, you see?
Things were very primitive at the start, but gradually they improved.
We did actually have a loo, and providing you were the bionic man, you could use it, because we used to have to use the loo and pick up this, 50-gallon churn of seawater to flush in, and then winch the churn down into the sea to get more water, you know? So, thank God, nobody on board had diarrhea.
We apologise to amateur radio operators in the 80-metre band if they are having trouble with our third harmonic. Reports, please, to the chief sound engineer, Radio Invicta, Folkestone, Kent.
Phil Perkins came into the forts because he complained. He was a ham. For some reason or another, the harmonic of Radio Invicta interfered with his reception or his transmission or one or the other, and he phoned Tom Pepper to complain. And Tom said, well, if you can do better, you come down and fix it, you see. So Phil thought, right, well, what I'll do is I'll come down and I'll sort of go out on the fort. It'll be nice to see what they're doing there. I'll sort out the equipment and go back home, back to my own job. He didn't reckon on Tom Pepper, because Tom got him out there, and Phil took one look at the equipment, which was unbelievable. It was a 1 kilowatt transmitter. And he said, how the hell do you ever get this lot to work anyway? He set about rewiring the studio. He tuned up the transmitter. He built an amplifier stage, which increased the power. He organised the aerial, so instead of having a piece of wire strung between two poles, which unfortunately were not insulated, so that the whole of the forts were being used as an aerial, giving a tremendous distortion. Somebody had stuck a metal pole and the transmission wire onto the metal pole, but the metal pole was connected to the metal fort. In fact, the largest aerial in the Guinness Book of Records is the English Channel under Radio Invicta.
The station reached as far as London, playing a mixture of pop and middle-of-the-road music, and soon began to build up an audience.
I devised a programme called Pop Luck, where we invited, this is for Simon, where we invited the listener to send in a postcard with a number on it, any number between 1 and, I remember, it was 9,300. And this was supposed to correspond with a number on one of the records in the studio. Now, the fact that we only had about 200 records in the studio made no difference, you see. Think big. To make things a little bit more tricky, we said that we would give a number out at the beginning of the programme and we would either add it or deduct it from the number the listener wrote on a piece of paper. Now, that was clever thinking, because I thought to myself, well, if we just take any record, we say, well, this is number 6,429, and somebody up in Norfolk thinks, oh, I like that record, I'll write in for it. Then we might be flummoxed when we get this card asking for 6,429 and finally we play something entirely different. So we had to devise this method of getting round it. And it worked. Because we played everything. I took out a few soundtrack albums like A Dentist's Drill and all that sort of thing, you know. And the programme worked. It was an absolute wow. And Sexy Simon did very well out of it. He was getting upwards of 150 letters a week, which is quite a lot for a small station, for this one programme. So it meant that everybody had their record played anyway, although when we went on the air, we said that the post office's mail boat was just coming out, sort of weighed down with sacks, as Tom brought the lot up in a margarine box, you know.
But of course, advertising was needed. Tom Pepper dealt with this in his own particular way.
He barged into the offices of the News of the World and said, oh, I want to see the chairman. Somehow or another, and I don't exactly know how, but he got in to see the chairman. And he said, I want your commercials on my station. This man was so taken back with Tom and so intrigued by this. He said, well, all right, I'll tell you what I'll do. We normally put everything through our advertising agents, but you show me that you can advertise the News of the World and come back and see me. So Tom came and saw me, and we worked it out, and for two Sundays, we did the News of the World adverts. Read it in the News of the World tomorrow. The News of the World had, they'd liked what they'd heard. They liked Tom's approach. They liked the unusualness of the situation. And they were prepared to give us a contract, not for very much, a couple of £1,000, you know. But for us, it would have meant a new lease. We need some equipment and several things.
Unfortunately, things were not to go well for Radio Invicta. On the 16th of December 1964, Tom Pepper set out in his launch David to take supplies to the station. He left the fort taking DJ Simon Ashley and engineer Martin Shaw with him, but this time a storm was blowing up. Ed Marino, who should have been on the boat, remembers the events after this.
In the evening, about 6 o'clock in the evening, I think it was, we had a visitor, and it was a police launch. And they came up and checked everybody, and we thought, well, you know, what's going on? We didn't know. They asked for me, and of course I was there, and I thought, oh, God, you know, what have I done? Parking tickets or something like that. And then they said, we thought that you were dead. Because I hadn't been on the air that day, because I was not supposed to be there, you know. And I said, well, why should I be dead? And then they told me that they'd found Tom's body, and they knew from Tom's wife that I was with him. But having listened to the station all day, not hearing me on the air, and only hearing those that should have been there anyway, they thought I'd gone down. The police said, well, we're going to take you off now because we need you to identify and help us and all that sort of thing. And I said, I'm not going off, not until I've done this commercial. And they said, well, you know, we've got to get you off now because the tides and all that sort of thing. And I said, well, I'm not going until until I did this tribute, you see. And the two boys hadn't been found, and there was still a remote chance that they might still be alive. And so I refused to leave until I'd been able to say something to be broadcast the following day. We'd closed down at 6 o'clock that evening anyway, you see. So they said, well, we haven't got time to let you sort of do other stuff. I grabbed a piece of music and spoke out of the top of my head. And literally, as I finished speaking, the police sort of grabbed me and took me into the launch and whipped me back to Whitstable. And that was it. They never found the other two boys, but they did find a body in Spain. In the pocket was a tape of some Radio Invicta programs. And it could have been Simon, it could have been Martin, we don't know. But it was a terrible end to a very happy, friendly station.
The station continued for a few months until February 1965. Then a new sound was heard from Red Sands.
Heralding a new big sound of music and news over London, this is the KING test transmission. The prelude to a new big sound of music and news over London, this is KING and a test transmission.
This was in March. The day started at 7 with continuous music, then came Mike and Mandy Raven's breakfast show. During the morning, there were country and western Latin American and folk music shows.
You're tuned to KING, transmitting on 236 metres on the medium wave band. The time, 33 minutes past 1 p.m. You're listening to Lunchbox, introduced by myself, Roger Gomez. And now it's time for myself, Roger Gomez, to tell you about the KING Lucky Carl Sticker Number and such like competition. The idea of this competition is that on the back of all our car stickers, they've got a different number printed, and you might be the lucky one who wins. You see, each week we have a draw, and if you've got a car sticker with the number which is drawn upon the back, then you're lucky and you get a small prize. I'm not going to tell you how small, but it's pretty small anyway. If you want a car sticker because you want to enter for this glorious competition, or also simply because you want to display it upon your car, upon the back of your head, or anywhere you wish to advertise this glorious station, then all you have to do is send a postcard or a letter to this address. Car Stickers, King Radio, Oxford House, Folkestone, Kent. Car Stickers, King Radio, Oxford House, Folkestone, Kent. And upon this postcard or letter, demand as many car stickers as you feel you have the gall to demand, and they'll send them to you because they're good like that.
Continuing through the afternoon with Memory Lane, Lucky Numbers, which was identical to the Invicta Potluck show, new releases, and then Mike Raven's R&B show until close down at 7 in the evening. But this format didn't attract enough listeners, so it was decided to call in help.
I was farming. I'd been previously managing director of an advertising agency for a number of years. I'd been farming for about 3 years. After having got the farm going, this was on Romney Marshes, found it rather boring, and an old client of my advertising agency asked me if I'd like to start a PR outfit with him, and I agreed to do that out of boredom. And almost immediately my farm accountants got in touch with me and said that they got some little men who had a pirate radio station on a fort in the Thames, but didn't know anything about how to get advertising, didn't I know something about advertising. So I listened to this station, which you could barely hear, and was quite dreadful, and certainly you'd have never raised any revenue off it. So I went back to the farm and wrote overnight my idea of the format of a station and how much it would cost to get it on the air and make it a going concern. And that came to about £25,000. I didn't expect to hear anything from these four men ever again, but they had muttered about knowing men who owned racehorses and large businesses and so on. And lo and behold, at the end of a week, they came back and said, the man with the racehorses or whatever, he's going to buy us out, providing you will run the radio station. So I tossed with my partner, Roger Coombs, as to who ran the radio station, and I lost, and I ran the radio station. And that's really how I got in it. Of course, having been in it for a very short while, I was hooked like everybody else is who gets attached to radio stations.
If you've enjoyed our programmes on KING, please tune to 390 metres in the medium wave band.
I was going to change the name, in fact, to Radio Eve, because I reckon that the pop audience in this country was overserved, if anything, and I felt that the middle-of-the-road people had been totally neglected by everybody, and that the housewife at home particularly had been neglected, and she was what I felt was the natural radio audience. So I was going to call it Radio Eve, Woman's Magazine of the Air. And then I realised it was just at the time when the press were realising that we might be taking some of their revenue away, and that they might mention Radio Eve because it was a novel conception, but may never mention our wavelength. So that was when I decided to call it 390, because that was our wavelength in metres. I had more difficulty in recruiting people to work on a radio station than, say, Caroline or London, because all those people who wanted to hear their voices on the air and have fan mail felt that that's where the fan mail would come from. And when they knew that they were going to be playing Ray Noble, Irving Berlin, Jerome Kern, they were horrified. But in fact, of course, in the end, they got far more fan mail.
Before I got there, I very rarely listened to 390. I used to tune past it and think, ugh, that's 390. Horrors. But I suppose it was quite a good station. It wasn't my kind of music, and really it still isn't. It served a very large listenership, had a very large following. It was very popular with those people, and I suppose it shouldn't be knocked on those grounds.
I think it was successful because we genuinely cared. I think our audience identified with us very, very quickly. We represented several kinds of protest, a protest against monopoly radio, a protest against silly government attitudes towards radio anyway. After a time it became a bit of a crusade, and I think people supported us in this. They felt that there were other ways of doing radio than the BBC, that there were other things than pop music. We had no bad language, and it makes me sound a bit like Mrs. Whitehouse, which I hope I'm not. But I reckon that, you know, I may swear like a trooper, but I don't in front of my children. And people listening to radio, it's no good saying, well, you can always switch off, because you can't. It's happened by the time. And if you've got to explain to your children what rape means, or, you know, some four-letter word, you're stuck with it, you know. In fact, I had a little notice up in the studios on the fort which said, if you wonder who you're talking to your mother.
Taylor Bury recalled how the station was set up. Alan West remembers his first view of the fort.
I thought, God, they don't expect me to climb up that, do they? I was absolutely horrified. I've never seen anything like it in my life.
But it wasn't all that bad, as Graham Gill said.
You wouldn't believe it was Radio 390 on the forts. We had our own sports room and gymnasium with a table tennis and with these rings you can swing around on, you know, and doing things like that. We had a television room completely carpeted. We had a very good dining room. Jeff was our cook at the time. I can't think of his other name, but we had excellent English Australian meals, you know, roast beef and Yorkshire pud for Sunday dinner.
The studios were quite nice. There were two Garrard 301s, a little microphone which looked rather like a pencil. Oh, there were two Spotmasters, which was something I hadn't expected out there. There was a ferrograph. We used to play the Dr. John tapes on, or Dr. Paul, or whatever his name was. So on the BBC, they had the Flying Doctor, didn't they? And we had Dr. Paul out there, who was the Sinking Doctor. I do remember in the studio, we used to give the on-hour interval signal with... this is real 30s radio. On the panel, there was a xylophone. And to give the station's interval signal, which was three tones on this xylophone, one actually picked up a hammer. And we used to have the most enormous fun with this. And I think it was Edward Cole in whom we performed the trick of removing the xylophone, and he was hitting the panel three times, which was quite fun. Or turning the xylophone back to front. Get the interval signal back to front. But at that time I had an agent. She insisted that all her clients should be paid reasonable or equitable money. I can't remember exactly what it was. I think it must have been about £35 a week, which these days is nothing. But then it was quite good, especially when you didn't have to pay for anything while you were out there.
I'll say one thing about Radio 390. When you worked, your salary was always paid on time. It was there, you know. You didn't have these problems of having to sort of beg for your money when you come off.
Trust you have enjoyed a lunchtime edition of From Me to You, and then we'll get our evening programme tonight at 7:30. And now until I greet you again later in the day, this is Graham Gill bidding you good afternoon.
The fault was only part of the story.
We had very broken down offices in Pimlico in a condemned building, and I can remember that the Financial Times put a photograph of a black couch that I had there and said, you know, this is where this guy, me, lives and works and so on. And they put a picture alongside it of my desk covered with snow because the roof had a hole in it. And when it snowed, which it did in that particular first winter, the snow used to lay on my desk in the morning before I realised a piece of plastic would help. So they were pretty primitive, but a great deal of gusto. You know, everybody enjoyed it.
An important thing for any commercial radio station was advertising, but there were problems.
Nobody knew how to sell radio time in those days.
However, these were sorted out.
I think our very first advertiser was Rivali.
Are you as choosy about music as I am? If you are, you probably like to choose other things carefully too. And that means this week's Rivali Car Contest is just made for you. Yes, this week's winner can choose. Now listen carefully. Either a Jaguar 3.4 automatic plus a £1,000 mink coat, or a new style Vauxhall Cresta, an automatic Mini Miner, a mink and £75, or an automatic Morris 1100, a completely new Riley Kestrel, a mink and £120, or a new big engine Singer Vogue, an automatic Austin Mini, a mink and £135. Wow, that's a prize and a half. Get your entry form from this week's Revalley. It's just sixpence.
Our second advertiser was News of the World. Beecham's were on. We launched Mother's Pride Bread. And in fact, that was placed with us by JWT, J. Walter Thompson. And they were the first people who really cared about matching an ad to an audience. They did 5 launch ads for Mother's Pride Bread. And they were so good that ladies would ring us up and say, somebody told me there were 5 Mother's Pride ads and I've only heard 3. Can you tell me when the other 2 are coming up? I've heard the one that goes something or other. And you know, you can't have better than that.
There was Edward Cole, who used to do his knitting in front of the microphone. Paul Beresford, Peter James, was the programme director at that time. Tony Windsor's brother, Tony or Withers, his proper name, John Withers, was the general manager. Ted Albury wasn't even in charge of the station then. It was a guy, a solicitor from Folkestone called David Lay, who was the managing director of the company, Estuary Radio.
And the day's music from the shows was presented by David Sinclair. You're in tune with your British family station, Radio 390. The time is 12 midday.
Frozen food values mean big savings for you this week at your Safeway supermarket. Just listen to these grand offers. Bird's Eye frozen peas, the £1 handy pack bag for just 2 shillings. Save 6p. Bird's Eye beef burgers, the 3 and 3 pack for just 2 and 9 at Safeway. Findus fish fingers, the 10-ounce pack for 2 and 3, a saving of 6p. Findus frozen Florida orange juice, the 2 and 3 tin for just 1 and 9. Bird's Eye chicken pie, the 3 and 8 pie, is just 3 shillings. Save at Safeway. It's probably the biggest frozen food sale ever held in England. Safeway, England's finest food store.
Jack McLaughlin, he'd close the station down and push the national anthem cartridge on the air, and then just left it, you know, because they're supposed to switch off by themselves. He went upstairs to get himself something to eat. There was a fault with the cartridge machine, and the national anthem, I think, must have played through the whole evening till about 7 in the morning when the station opened up again.
New transmitting and studio equipment had been installed on Radio 390, greatly improving its output. An FM service was planned, as well as a northern station, which Ted Albury recalls.
There were 2 things that I wanted to do that I was very, very keen on doing. One was to have one off in the Irish Channel to be 390 North, to cover that side of the country. We covered up to Hull and perhaps into Coventry and down to Bournemouth. But the more important thing to me was that I wanted, off the money that we made on 390, to run a children's radio station with no advertising at all, so that nobody could say, you know, your daddy's nasty if he doesn't buy you Smarties. I feel that no matter how careful people try to be in advertising things for children, there is going to be an element of exploitation in that, and I thought I could show that it was possible to run a children's radio station all day long.
But these other services were never to be. On the 24th of November 1966, the owners were taken to court.
The one at Canterbury was perfectly straightforward, dealt with by the magistrates perfectly properly, I thought. The one in the High Court was interesting because, of course, it was not a unanimous verdict. Lord Justice Salmon, as he now is, disagreed and said, no, you found no offence committed at all. Lord Widgery sort of balanced between the two extremes, and I think went on the basis that, you know, obviously the government wanted us out, so if you were going to overbalance one way or another, it'd better overbalance for the establishment, which is totally understandable. I said that I was always prepared to do something unauthorised, but was never prepared to do anything that was illegal. So I arranged that as soon as that verdict was given, the station closed down, and I'd already pre-recorded a closing down message. The whole of that case depended upon whether we were in or out of territorial waters, and an arcane piece of law was dragged up by the government, which said that if a sandbank dried out for 24 hours on any day in the year, you can measure another 3 miles from there, because it had already been proved that we were outside the 3 mile limit. But when you measured another 3 miles on, obviously they got us. And charts were brought to show that they were corrected to the appropriate dates and so on, and that this sandbank was shown as drying out. I then had a telephone call from one of Her Majesty's hydrographers, who shall be nameless, but a very important one, who said, "You realise you've been conned, don't you?" And I said, "No, I didn't." And he said, "Well, when it says on a chart that a chart has been corrected to such and such a date, it doesn't mean that it's been corrected. All it means is that any corrections that have been done are not later than that date. So a chart can have an awful lot of errors on it because sandbanks move." Having felt I was conned, I started us up again and said, OK, you know, we'll fight the second round. I did a little introductory message to say we're back on the air, and this is what I always intended playing if we went back on the air, and I played Frankie Sinatra's second time around, which I think amused the press at the time and got us back into publicity, which was what it was meant to do.
After this, further action was taken by the post office. As a result, the station was forced to close on the 28th of July 1967.
To an injunction imposed in the High Court today at the request of the post office, Radio 390 is now required to cease broadcasting. We should like to express our immense appreciation to the millions of listeners who have always supported us during the past 2 years and through our many struggles to stay on the air. It is very disappointing to all of us that we aren't able to continue to provide you with the programs you enjoy, but perhaps one day we'll be allowed to do so again. Until then, on behalf of Mr. Lai, our London office, the relief staff and everybody here, I should like to say goodbye.
I think now I feel more strongly about what radio should be like in this country than I felt right at the beginning of that or even at the end of that, because I know more now about it. We've seen what the BBC's answer to the pirates were. We've seen what the IBA's answer to the pirates were, and they ain't the answers. They didn't even